The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to The Christian Outlook, the weekly radio program that sorts through the issues in our fast-changing world in a way that honors your Christian faith. Brought to you in partnership with our sponsor, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Don Crow. This week, after weeks of conflict, we'll look at what's behind the rocket attacks on Israel from Hamas.
We know that Palestinian Islamic Jihad and Hamas are funded by the theocrats in Tehran.
The Supreme Court takes up an abortion case from Mississippi.
The more attention drawn to the unborn baby, the more the pro-life argument gains traction, not only in the law, but in hearts.
The CDC eases its recommended mask mandate. The states have a hard time getting the message.
What exactly do they think the vaccine was for?
Governor Cuomo received a $5 million advance on his deceptive book released at the peak of the pandemic. For those who get their news only from the elite media outlets, they didn't even hear about it.
ABC, NBC, CBS, not one story about this governor's blood money.
We have all this and more. I'm your host, Don Crow, coming to you from my home station of WAVA in Washington, D.C. Available at WAVA.com. Also through the TuneIn radio app. Thanks for joining us today. We'll begin in Israel with a look behind the current conflict. In one sense, this conflict between Israel and Hamas has parallels of what we've seen before. The terrorist group Hamas shoots rockets at Israel, and, like any other nation in such a situation would do, Israel responds. And then Israel gets pressured for a ceasefire. But there are some differences as well, including the changes here in the U.S., the nation that used to be Israel's most dependable ally. I turn to Cliff May of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies.
We know that Palestinian Islamic Jihad and Hamas are funded, armed, and instructed by the theocrats in Tehran. We know that, just as we know that the theocrats in Tehran are funding, arming, and instructing Hezbollah in Lebanon, which is now a failing state. They're funding, arming, and instructing the Houthis in Yemen, which the UN says is the world's worst humanitarian crisis. And they're funding, arming, and instructing the Assad dictatorship in Syria, where more than 500,000 people have been killed by the regime, and about 5 million or more have been displaced. They're homeless. All is going on at the same time.
Talk further about how we've gotten to this situation so rapidly. Is it simply because of the shift of administration and the driving forces behind this, Iran, a case in point, now feel like they have the Biden administration where they would like them, and they're not going to get the kind of pushback they would have gotten previously.
I think you're right. I mean, we saw what happened during the Trump administration. Their leading terrorist, Qasem Soleimani, was eliminated. And I think they would fear something like that. They don't fear something like that anymore than they did during the Obama administration. They don't like the Abraham Accords. And the Biden administration is at best ambivalent about the Abraham Accords. So this makes it harder for the Bahrainis, the Emiratis, the Saudis to support Israel at a time when the Palestinians are suffering, though the Palestinians are suffering because when you launch hundreds and hundreds of missiles and rockets into Israel, Israel will strike back. They will do so in a way that is meant to minimize civilian casualties, but that's hard to do because Hamas routinely uses innocent civilians as human shields. Hamas, though it has factories to manufacture missiles, does not have shelters for its people, except for those who are in Hamas. They can go underground. And it keeps human shields in front of in hospitals and other places where they have command and control and the storage of weapons. So I think they thought they could break the Abraham Accords. And they could also hurt Israel at an interesting time. Right now, there's an Arab party. Arabs vote. Arabs run for office. Arabs in Israel serve as judges, Supreme Court justices. They serve in parliament. They are doctors and integrated hospitals, everything. Right now, the Arab party has been doing rather well. Its leader, Mansour Abbas, is sort of a kingmaker. There is a chance that he might come into one of the coalitions with the Jewish parties. I don't think the rulers of Iran like that, so they want to make that more difficult to do. They have all sorts of reasons for doing this. I think they also may have thought they would prevail. They have, but I would say right now the Israelis have by far the better hand.
One more quick question. It's out of a column at Human Events. Tlaib and Omar say Israel is the aggressor. Subheadline is, I don't think so. It's written by the staff at Human Events. But down in the column it says that it seems that these lawmakers are ignoring the fact that 1,050 rockets were fired at Israel in just 40 hours, forcing mayhem and destruction on the lives of innocent Israeli citizens. And I think it's disturbing to a lot of Americans who say our own government, our own Congress is honeycombed with severe sympathizers toward these violent elements in the Middle East and very anti-Israel. Is that a fair assessment or not?
It's a very fair assessment. It'd be one thing if they said, look, I wish the Israelis would find a way to sit down with the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank and negotiate. But Hamas is an organization openly committed not just to jihad, but to the genocide of all Jewish Israelis and any Muslims who are friendly with them. That's open. That's in their charter. They talk about it over and over again. Hamas also is an offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood, which is also why the Emiratis, the Bahrainis, and the Saudis, the Egyptians, none of them like the Muslim Brotherhood because they know what the Muslim Brotherhood wants to do to them, cut their heads off as well. So it's one thing to say, I support the Palestinian Authority. Israel has relations with them. I want to see those relations get better. But that's not what Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib and AOC are saying, and Bernie Sanders. That's not what they're saying. They're defending Hamas, which is a group that is terrorist, that is Muslim Brotherhood, and is openly committed to genocide against the only thriving, surviving Jewish community in the entire Middle East. That is troubling, and I wish I could say that I saw more members of Congress, particularly on the Democratic side of the aisle, say not just supporting Israel, but also directly criticizing those members of Congress who support a terrorist organization.
In 2018, the Mississippi State Legislature passed a bill that sought to prohibit abortion after 15 weeks of pregnancy. Then Governor Phil Bryant signed the bill saying, "I am committed to making Mississippi the safest place in America for an unborn child." It's no surprise that the bill was challenged in the courts. But it did surprise a number of observers when the Supreme Court this week announced that they'll be hearing a challenge to Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization. Here's Albert Mohler from his briefing program.
Very big news on the abortion front. The Supreme Court announced that it would accept a case and it would hear it and decide it in its next term, an abortion case coming from the state of Mississippi. Officially, the court handed down a writ of certiorari. That means that it is going to allow a hearing. That particular action by the court requires at least four justices to concur that the court will hear a case. The vast majority of cases that are at least appealed to the Supreme Court are never heard because the court doesn't have time to take all the cases. The justices tend to pick the cases that they think will be of the greatest constitutional importance. This is a case known as Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization, and ground zero for this case is Jackson, Mississippi, and an abortion clinic, an infamous abortion clinic there. And the state of Mississippi has adopted legislation that makes illegal abortions after the 15th week of a woman's term. That becomes very important because the Supreme Court, at least at this point, following the Roe v. Wade decision of 1973 and then the Casey decision a generation later, has basically said that the state may intervene to make abortion illegal or restricted after the fetus reaches the point of viability, which is generally considered about 24 weeks. We're talking here about a 9-week difference, and we're talking about saving many unborn lives. The state of Mississippi also has adopted a so-called trigger bill. That's a bill that would make all abortion illegal if the Supreme Court were to reverse the Roe v. Wade decision of 1973. This particular legislation is an effort to at least restrict abortion further. And that approach in general was authorized by the Supreme Court in that Casey decision. But what you see in the mainstream media, and it's coming to us in a torrent, and it's coming from the pro-abortion side, is that the court has just announced it's going to take a case which could mean the reversal of Roe. They hold that up for fundraising reasons. They hold that up for political reasons and attention-getting reasons, and it's very successful. Should conservatives, should pro-lifers see this case as the grand opportunity to reverse Roe? Well, not yet, but we do understand this is a big, big development, and it is big, big good news. I want to tell you why it's big good news. I want to put it into two particular arguments. Number one, the pro-life movement has learned that it simply isn't the case that we can expect the Supreme Court in one decision to just eliminate Roe. That was probably from the beginning unlikely. But instead, the Supreme Court, and especially with a conservative majority, and particularly now that the court has as one of its members not Ruth Bader Ginsburg, the late justice, but rather Amy Coney Barrett, appointed by President Trump, we're looking at a very different situation. Conservative pro-lifers should look at the development as very good news for what I often refer to as the cumulative case theory of the pro-life movement. And that is that you will have pro-life legislation and pro-life lawyers working to erode Roe v. Wade step by step, law by law, restriction by restriction, court precedent by court precedent. And, of course, this could be a very, very big court precedent. Could the Supreme Court reverse Roe? Yes, it could. Is that the most likely issue? Probably not, given the way that the court has announced it's going to take the case. But here's something else, and here's very good news. It is likely that those four justices who were behind the decision to grant a hearing to the case have reason to assume that the plaintiffs in this case, arguing on behalf of the defense of human life, have a very good opportunity to win. But the second issue, and I'll close on this, is even more important. Notice that the Mississippi law, and thus this particular Supreme Court case, focuses on the life of the unborn child. That, morally and theologically and biblically speaking, is the biggest issue here. We have to keep pointing to the unborn child. We have to keep pointing to that invisible unborn child who we believe from the moment of fertilization is an image bearer of God and deserving of the full dignity and sanctity and protection of life. The more attention that must be drawn to the unborn child, that unborn baby, the more the pro-life argument gains traction, not only in the law, not only in the courts, not only in legislatures, and not only in minds, but in hearts. We need to hope and pray right now that the Supreme Court hands down the right decision in this case, sustaining the dignity and sanctity of unborn life. It is not likely to take that question as far as we want it to be taken, but we understand that this is progress, and this is good news for the unborn. And we need to pray not only for a change in the law, not only for a change in the court, not only for a change in precedent. We need to pray for a change in American hearts so that those hearts have the basic moral instinct and intuition to defend all human life, including especially life in the womb.
Coming up, the CDC eases mask restrictions. Are the states listening?
What exactly do they think the vaccine was for?
Stay with us. The Christian Outlook returns in a moment.
As we consider a post-COVID world, the call goes forth to a new generation of leaders in politics and policy. I'm Pete Peterson, Dean of Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. And for over two decades, we've prepared students to apply America's founding principles to today's policy debates. Are you considering graduate school? Find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Christian Outlook. I'm Don Crow. Late last week, the CDC eased mask restrictions indoors and out for those who have received the vaccination. It was touted as a great sign of progress and greeted with a sense of relief. But the message from a number of key states and key governors was, not so fast. Charmaine Yost of the Heritage Foundation was a guest of Kevin McCullough on AM 570 The Mission in New York City.
All these governors that have been in super lockdown mode and saying it was because of the CDC's guidance that they were doing all of that? No, they're not. It's not good enough for them that the CDC says this now. They need to sign off on it. These little dictates in these little offices that they hold, holding on to this power that we don't really ever remember giving them. Charmaine, it was the best of times. It was the worst of times. I simultaneously heard people say, "Oh, I'm so glad." And in the next breath go, "What? Murphy's doing what? Cuomo's doing what?" Your reaction.
Well, you know, Kevin, this is the common sense approach that normal people have been following all along. I think that there's always been an understanding that masks were there to be a little bit barrier. But, you know, to me, what I'm dumbfounded by is seeing not just these politicians. You know, we kind of expect them to play politics and to play games with this stuff. But some of the doctors that you're seeing out there, like Dr. Leanna Wen, former head of Planned Parenthood, by the way, not coincidentally, I don't think, coming out and saying how bad it was for us to be taking masks off and that this was going to endanger everybody. And the question is, like, what exactly do they think the vaccine was for? You know, the people who are not getting vaccinated, that's their choice. But it is now available to anyone everywhere. I saw some data this morning saying that there's nobody who lives beyond 5 miles away from a place where vaccine is available. So,
right.
I mean, this is something we should be excited about. We should be moving forward into the summer. We're way ahead of this idea that somehow we were going to have, you know, these precious little July 4th celebrations with only a handful of people. You know, it's almost like, can we not like be happy for a change? But let me throw another thing in here into the mix, Kevin, that's really kind of bothering me right now, is that in the midst of all this positive forward momentum that we're seeing, we've still got the teachers unions who are dug in, and they were prioritized. Teachers were prioritized at the front of the line with vaccines, and yet they're still refusing to go back to the classroom. And I have yet to hear any kind of rationale that, whether it masquerades as scientific or not, that gives you a reason, an excuse for teachers just to flat out refuse to work. And the only answer is that the teachers unions, for whatever reason, some sort of, you know, are going against it.
New York State, you'll remember, was hit hardest by the pandemic, especially in those early months. And the key decisions from Governor Cuomo made the death toll markedly worse. But the governor, at peak pandemic, was writing a book. The title, American Crisis: Leadership Lessons from the COVID-19 Pandemic. And we now know he received a $5 million advance. Janice Dean is the senior meteorologist for Fox News, who lost her mother and her father-in-law to COVID in senior care facilities in New York. She was a guest of Kevin McCullough.
We know how much he got. We know when he got it. We know pretty much when he was negotiating for it, Janice. I didn't think this story could make him look any worse. It got worse.
Right. $5 million. And, you know, when I first heard that he was writing a book in the summer last year, I thought it was a joke. I thought it was a headline in, you know, one of those satire columns, the Babylon Bee or the Onion. Governor Cuomo writing a book, meanwhile, thousands dying in nursing homes. It blew my mind then. And then when we found out it was upwards of $5 million in an advance for this book, it was just, you know, I don't hate anyone in this world, but it's really hard not to hate this man for what he has done to thousands of families and the fact that he lined his pockets, profiting off the deaths of thousands of New Yorkers.
In a state that is politically lopsided as New York, Janice, there's been a lot of discussion about the hopelessness that people that want common sense back into government will ever feel the opportunity to receive it. Andrew Cuomo was the personification of that because he carried out his agenda within his party. He does to this day with kind of an iron fist. Does he ultimately get away with this in your mind? And does this factor that he got rich by killing grandma? And he did it with a seeming lack of remorse that I've seldom seen in serial killers, much less public servants.
Yeah, he has no empathy whatsoever. To this day, I've never really heard him say, "I'm sorry for your loss." You know, any accountability, he's blamed everyone, including God and Mother Nature and even the people in the elder care facilities. They were old. They're going to die. You played that clip of "Who cares? They died." You know, that's really one of the toughest things to watch, is that he's still on television And he's still saying, I mean, crazy stuff. He was joking around about the sexual harassment stuff again, and he continues to get away with it. And I blame Albany lawmakers. I think they are complicit. I think they are spineless. They're weak. They're scared. It's really disgusting to see our paid representatives just cowering to this, you know, disgusting human being. That, and, you know, part of it is their fault.
Yeah. We have a lot of different ways that we can go with this, Janice. I mean, people can certainly look at this and kind of nod their head and say, yep, that's terrible. That's too bad. They really should do something about that. Or we can actively get involved. Let me ask you about our industry, the TV radio world that you and I work in. Should the media be doing more in this regard, or has the Albany and Manhattan elite in that circle also failed us here?
Totally failed us. FoxNews.com just came out with a report about how none of the big networks covered the $5 million payout. So the ABC, NBC, CBS, not one story about this governor's blood money. You know, we all know that if this was Governor DeSantis that lined his pockets with $5 million after helping kill over 15,000 people and then covering it up and then having nine women come forward about Me Too stuff, oh my gosh, if your head is not exploding right now, what is going to get us to that point of realizing that we are just completely being manipulated?
You know, when you put it in those kinds of perspectives, you would think this would be a major national story, not to mention a local one in Albany and Manhattan on any level. Think about this, Janice. Terrorists that we did not know were going to do so took down our two biggest buildings and killed a couple of thousand New Yorkers on a single day. This governor, with far more advanced understanding of what's going on, killed nearly eight times the number of New Yorkers that Osama bin Laden has. And you can't get the media to talk about it.
Protect and ignore. That's what they've been doing this whole time. They propped him up when he was selling his book and when he was going around as the pandemic politician, selling his posters and then his book and going on CNN with his brother and joking around about COVID tests, when now we know that the governor and his friends and family were getting COVID tests when nursing homes couldn't get them. I mean, the list goes on. I could fill a book with all of the terrible things and what appears to be illegal stuff that this guy has done over the last year. I don't even know what to say anymore.
Coming up,
America's on the verge of driving out all that's there in the biblical roots of the American experiment.
Oz Guinness, when the Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Christian Outlook, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. I'm Don Crow. It was Monday, March 16th, 2020, when President Trump announced 15 days to stop the spread. And it was May 25th last year when George Floyd lost his life in Minneapolis. Those dates are perhaps trigger points. The pandemic, the violent unrest, the protests revealed tensions in our nation that have left many asking the big questions about the American experiment. Oz Guinness watched the unrest of the late 60s. So he has a unique vantage point on where we are today. He was a guest of Eric Metaxas. We'll pick up with Oz on the formative nature of the Bible on our nation.
If you go back to the scriptures, notions like human worth, made in the image of God, truth, freedom, justice, peace, these all have an incredible richness and depth that is unrivaled. I mean, you take our atheist friends, they have no grounding for freedom. Or we take our friends on the left, or our opponents on the left. They talk justice, but their views go in entirely different directions. Christians, certainly Jews too, we should go out with confidence, get off the back foot. This is a time when the good news of the Bible as a whole, and certainly Jesus, is the best news ever for humanity.
What we have goes back to Moses. I mean, it's an amazing thing. If you go around the state capitals in America, you will see murals of Moses holding up the law. But it hasn't been taught for 50 years. You certainly will not hear it in public discourse. They hardly ever talk about patriotism, as though, because some people call that a dirty word or think of it in negative ways, they don't want to touch on anything that might smack of chest beating nationalism. It's really kind of pathetic in a way that they have allowed themselves to go that far, because what you're saying is this is inescapable. This is at the heart of every good thing that we have in the nation.
Absolutely. It's unique. It's original. It's distinctive. And it's an incredible answer for humanity. So I argue in the book that this notion is the once and future key to freedom, in the sense you don't understand the American experiment. It's inexplicable without understanding, say, the covenant. But equally, you can't have freedom in the future in any solid way without understanding it. So we who care about humanity, care about justice, freedom, words, and these things, we need to explore them and then go out with courage and declare these things and argue with them and prevail in arguments against either the crazies on the left or whoever else doesn't want to understand them. This is an incredible moment for humanity.
Well, I mean, again, you don't like to mention names, but I think that the New York Times has pushed the 1619 Project. They have been at the forefront of this rewriting of truth and fact and history. The New York Times.
The American Republic, this great experiment in ordered freedom, is on its last legs. Democracy approaching it, but America will survive. So people in the New York Times, I don't mind mentioning institutions, not only, say, the 1619 Project, some of the op-ed writers, you know how Barry Weiss was treated and so on. So there are many of our intellectual class who are either ignorant or committed to these ideas, and they're part of what will come. Now, you remember the notion of judgment in the scriptures. The notion of judgment is not God's arbitrarily zapping people whom he doesn't like. It's either his leaving them or sometimes driving them to the logic of their own settled choices. So let's be clear. America's on the verge of driving God out, and equally of driving out all that's there in the biblical roots of the American experiment. And judgment, in other words, retribution, the harvest of the consequences of our choices, is on the way. So you take the sexual revolution and say the transgender stuff today, the harvest of confusion of identity and the breakdown of families and social cohesion will be absolutely extraordinary. And as James Bryce, Lord James Bryce, predicted years ago, America would suffer what he called, if religion were to fail, the completest revolution of all, unraveling, unfraying, the breakdown. In other words, make no mistake, retribution is on the way, unless there's a turning around.
Already we're seeing judgment. I mean, what is going on, whether it is a pipeline being hacked, Israel on the verge of war, crisis at the border. I wonder if these things are driving people to the desperation of saying, God, we need you to help. Apart from you, we can't do it.
For the complete interview, go to ChristianOutlook.com. Coming up,
when you abandon truth and you say that it no longer exists any longer, the truth is just a construct. It's a social construction of what we decide it will be.
When the Christian Outlook returns in a moment.
As we consider a post-COVID world, the call goes forth to a new generation of leaders in politics and policy. I'm Pete Peterson, Dean of Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. And for over two decades, we've prepared students to apply America's founding principles to today's policy debates. Are you considering graduate school? Find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Christian Outlook. I'm Don Crow. Oz Guinness, in our last segment, made clear his conviction that we are living in very serious times. We are deliberately, in many cases, abandoning truth, even abandoning the idea of truth. Everett Piper is holding up the banner for a fresh reassertion of truth and a bold stance of Christian conviction. His latest book is titled, Grow Up. Life isn't safe, but it's good. He joined me on my program on WAVA. Talk about some of the issues in this culture that really I don't recall us ever having to face before. This whole phrase, for example, of cancel culture and progressive politics and BLM and critical race theory and on it goes. There are some serious dynamics that have these names that really most people may not understand, but they represent a real serious danger to our country and our culture, don't they?
They absolutely do. And I've been asked repeatedly, how did this happen? How did we get here? I firmly believe you have three entities in every culture that are responsible for inculcating the values and the ideas into their progeny, into their children and grandchildren, the generations that follow them. And those three entities would be the teachers, the preachers, and the parents. And I would argue that all three have dropped the ball. And the reason we're having this problem right now is we've created this monster. Teachers stopped teaching truth. They started elevating feelings over facts. They started attending to opinions rather than truths. Never once while I was a college president did I hand a diploma to anybody on graduation day and say, congratulations, you have a degree in opinions. I never once offered a major in opinions because that would be absurd. That would be absurd. You're supposed to learn something when you go to college. I'm not going to celebrate your opinion. I don't care what your opinion is. Learn what's true in your relative discipline of business and accounting and marketing and physics and biology and physiology. Learn what's true in literature and English. That's the point of education. But our teachers have dropped the ball and elevated feelings over facts. They've reversed the direction of the academy. The ivory tower has crumbled. And preachers, with a P, preachers have imbibed the Kool-Aid. Now we hear about affirming churches rather than confessional churches. If I hear one more word about an emergent evangelical church or an affirmational church, I'm going to scream. I don't go to church to be affirmed. I go to church to confess. I go to church to hear a good sermon on the need to repent. My land, we don't issue trigger warnings before altar calls. At least I hope we don't. And then parents, how's that helicopter parenting working for us? We've been hovering around our kids trying to be their best friend rather than accepting the responsibility of being their parents. So teachers and preachers and parents have been passing on terrible ideas, and they haven't been teaching the truth. They haven't been demanding maturity. They haven't been modeling adulthood to their kids. We're in this mess right now because garbage in, garbage out. And the solution just might be goodness in, goodness out, if we would return to the time-tested truths that God has given us as the parameters for human freedom. We can flourish within a good culture, one that's defined by God rather than a safe culture that's controlled by government.
And is this not really the seeds of it? Were they not being sown clear back in the days of one of your late colleagues, Francis Schaeffer, who insisted on that very point, that now we have to talk about truth with a capital T, true truth, as he called it?
Absolutely. When you abandon truth and you say that it no longer exists any longer, the truth is just a construct. It's a social construction of what we decide it will be. You get to this land of absurdity. It's the land that Isaiah warned us of, for bitter is sweet and sweet is bitter, and evil is good and good is evil. When we reverse definitions and claim the authority of God to define everything, when we eat of the fruit of the knowledge of good and evil and we displace God, we kick God out of the discussion, and we claim to be the authority over everything and the definers of all, we're in a very ugly place because truth doesn't exist any longer, just power.
Now, you say there are 20 lessons in this book. Can you walk us through some of those lessons?
Well, let's just take this one. One of the chapter titles is Don't Fall in the Pool. And in that particular chapter, I tell the story of Narcissus and how he was so infatuated with himself that he stood on the river's edge, this Greek god falling in love with his own image, infatuated with his own beauty. And what happens? He slips into the pool and he drowns. his self-infatuation, his love affair with himself, his childish adolescence was his death. This was a suicidal self-worship. And this is a perfect description of what's going on in our culture right now. Bill Maher just did a monologue 2 weeks ago where he said that the problem with today's culture is that the youth don't understand that with age comes wisdom. And he then went on to say, it's not that we don't understand what you're saying, speaking of old people to younger people. It's we do understand what you're saying. We do understand your ideas. And then to quote Bill Maher, he said, it's just that your ideas are stupid.
Another chapter, lesson number four, pack jumper cables.
This is a lesson of being prepared. I tell the story of how a graduate from college once received at his graduate party some jumper cables. It's kind of an absurd gift. But over the course of time, he recognized that all the other gifts, either the money was spent or the other gifts became obsolete. They were trinkets and toys that he didn't use anymore. But those jumper cables stayed with him for life. Those jumper cables represented practicality, being ready for the crisis. Not only the crisis that you might suffer with your own car, but now because you have those jumper cables, other people come to you to help you and ask you to solve their problems when they need their car jumped and it's stalled out on the road. So this is an anecdote of being prepared. Recognize that there are some ideas that have been around for a long time. They're biblical ideas. They're grounded in a Judeo-Christian ethic. These ideas were given to you by God. They weren't made up by government just yesterday. These ideas represent the jumper cables of life that allow you to respond to a crisis when it comes your way.
Lesson five, don't argue with the mechanic. And you quote Winston Churchill on this matter.
Well, this is the one where some people just know how to take care of things that you know nothing about, okay? So if you want your car fixed, take it to a mechanic and stop acting like you can diagnose it yourself. You know what those little sounds mean, and you go in and try to tell the mechanic what needs to be done with your car. Frankly, you probably, and I probably, don't know what we're talking about. Find a good mechanic and don't argue with him.
Coming up,
the problem we're having with the evangelical church today is a low view of Scripture.
A few more minutes with Everett Piper in the final segment of the Christian Outlook. Stay with us.
How great you are, my sun and my shield.
This is Jerry Boyer. Take a few minutes and join me for the first episode of my new podcast, Meeting of Minds with Jerry Boyer, where I interviewed the brilliant tech entrepreneur and thinker, Peter Thiel.
The idea of a victim, the idea that victims exist, it comes from Judeo-Christianity and nowhere else. You know, if you sort of imagine Christ in the time of Pontius Pilate, if he had told Pilate, you know, I am a victim, this would have made no sense whatsoever. Pilate would have said, no, are you a Roman citizen or not?
Here's Thiel on victimhood.
The idea that you were a victim made no sense at all. And it's maybe deformed, maybe gone crazy in modernity where we talk about victims and nothing else.
To hear Thiel on atheism, the Bible, Jesus, the cross and resurrection, political correctness and violence, and a whole lot more, go to meetingofmindspodcast.com. Listen, subscribe, and share. That's meetingofmindspodcast.com.
Welcome back to the Christian Outlook. I'm Don Crow. The challenges that we are facing in our nation are not the same as we are facing within the church, but the two are very much related. If we would like to see a positive change in the nation at large, we ought to prioritize change within ourselves and our personal commitment to Scripture. We'll pick up with Everett Piper and his challenge for us to listen to those who've gone before us.
The mechanic needs to be listened to because he has the experience, the knowledge of how to fix the car, whereas you and I probably don't. So listen to the people that have been around for a few years, more than we have, who understand how to apply those biblical principles and give us human freedom rather to enslave us in our own opinions and our own sin.
I'm deeply concerned. I'm sure you are. You've already mentioned one of the causal factors in any culture, one of the shaping forces is the church and the pulpit. And I'm deeply concerned about the recent seeming acceleration of compromised doctrine in the church itself, in the evangelical community, to where we're now agreeing and calling black white and white black, so to speak, in order to get along with everybody. Speak to the need to stay with the truth, as Jude so powerfully called for in contending for the faith in that one chapter little book so long ago.
Well, if the church buys the lie, if the church drinks the Kool-Aid of postmodernity, if the church diminishes the view of Scripture, the problem we're having with the evangelical church today is a low view of Scripture. If you do not believe in the inerrancy of the Word, the infallibility of the Word, that the Word is absolute, and that it is our final measuring rod outside of those things being measured, to quote C.S. Lewis, the church is the defender of the Word. The Word is the final measuring rod for the church. But unfortunately today, you have people like Andy Stanley saying that we need to unhitch ourselves from the Old Testament. Well, Jesus didn't unhitch himself from the Old Testament. Neither did any of the apostles. They honored the Old Testament. A low view of Scripture will always result in the elevation of man and the diminishment of God. It will result in the elevation of sin and the diminishment of confession. And that's what we see in our culture right now, because we haven't, the church hasn't preached confession and repentance. It's turned into a church of affirmation and enablement rather than one that stands on biblical truth.
That wraps up this edition of the Christian Outlook. Thanks for joining us today. You can catch my full conversation with Everett Piper at ChristianOutlook.com. And while you're there, remember to subscribe to our podcast. And if you're a regular, take a minute and give us a good rating through Apple Podcast or wherever you've signed up for the program. And let me introduce you to another podcast that may be a nice fit for you or someone in your family. Jerry Boyer is a guest you've heard frequently on our program. He's out with a new podcast called Meeting of Minds. If you want deeper conversations, conversations away from the white-hot news cycle on issues that matter, go to meetingofmindspodcast.com. That's meetingofmindspodcast.com. Thanks for joining us today. Our program has been brought to you in part through our partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. For executive producer Russell Schumann and producers Charlie Richards and David Pouchon, Michael Cook and Alex Perez, I'm Don Crow. Join us again next time for The Christian Outlook. Expected.